Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hare. Gopi Jana Balaba Gadavadad Hare. Gopi Jana Balaba Gadavadad Hare. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jai Om Vishnupad Parabahamsa Parvraj Gachara Sotera Sata Shri Shimana's Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Kijai ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Kijai. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Pasai Bhutadaya Shimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Dhanamani Namaste Sarasana Sunya Daskara Siddha.
Oh. Is there, is my notebook that Kendall thing, is it, did you see it?
Not here.
No. I was sitting over there, maybe I left it. Okay.
Hi, Hare Krishna. So today's verse, we are reading from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5, text 18. Thank you very much. This is one familiar to many of you. Very, very nice verse, and I think very appropriate to so many things that we're seeing today. So we'll just go through it a couple times. Vijavanaya sampane Brahmane gavahastini Shuni chaiva svapake cha Pandita Samadarshana. Srila Prabhupada's translation and purport. The humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge, sees with equal vision a learned and gentle Brahmin, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater or outcast. Purport. A Krishna conscious person does not make any distinction between species or castes. The Brahmin and the outcast may be different from the social point of view, or a dog, a cow, or an elephant may be different from the point of view of species, but these differences of body are meaningless from the viewpoint of a learned transcendentalist. This is due to the relationship to the Supreme, for the Supreme Lord, by his plenary portion as Paramatma, is present in everyone's heart. Such an understanding of the Supreme is real knowledge. As far as the bodies are concerned, in different castes or different species of life, the Lord is equally kind to everyone because he treats every living being as a friend, yet maintains himself as Paramatma, regardless of the circumstances of the living entities. The Lord as Paramatma is present both in the outcast and in the Brahmin. Although the body of a Brahmin and that of an outcast are not the same, the bodies are material productions of different modes of material nature, but the soul and the super soul within the body are of the same spiritual quality. The similarity in the quality of the soul and the supersoul, however, does not make them equal in quantity, for the individual soul is present only in that particular body, whereas the Paramatma is present in each and every body. A Krishna conscious person has full knowledge of this, and therefore he is truly learned and has equal vision. The similar characteristics of the soul and the supersoul are that they are both conscious, eternal, and blissful. But the difference is that the individual soul is conscious within the limited jurisdiction of the body. The supersoul is present in all bodies without distinction. Om Gyanati Maranda Shagana Jana Salaka Chaksani Taramina Tasma Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchiko Patrubhishcha Kribi Sindhu Bibhicha Patitano Pavane Bhiva Vaishabhi Bhiva Namo Namaha. Oops. There's been a lot of things in the news and recent events that have sort of made me think of this verse. Excuse me. The first set of hearing aids I ever had, I just got. I'm still getting used to it. At least maybe I can hear the questions. About 2 weeks ago, in a Catholic school in the north, a person came to the windows with three or four weapons, proceeded to shoot, and killed two children and wounded about 21, mostly children. And then just a couple days ago in Colorado, there was a shooting in a school by a 16-year-old who apparently was a white supremacist and anti-Semitic, and he shot a couple people and then killed himself. And we could go on and on. You've all heard these. You can barely even look at the news without seeing some killing like this. And they've almost become commonplace. Now, in recent years, these have been classified and are called hate crimes. So what is a hate crime? A hate crime typically, I'm reading a definition, typically is one involving violence that is motivated by prejudice on the basis of ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, or similar grounds. In other words, there's no particular reason that a person was shot or killed or attacked or whatever it may have been, but simply because the person's religion, their race, their ethnic identification, the color of their skin, their sexual orientation, their gender, or whatever it might be. The FBI keeps statistics on these, and what they call hate crimes have doubled between 2015 and 2024. Just in the last 9 years, these have doubled. But yet, at the same time, it's not really new, is it, historically? There have always been one tribe trying to eliminate another tribe, or one group opposed to another group. We only have to go back within very recent memory to Nazi Germany. The Holocaust was basically one entire country's massive, horrendous hate crime, right? In other words, aimed at a particular group of people for no other reason than their particular religion or culture. The oldest recorded in Western history of hate crimes is probably the Roman persecution of the Christians 2,000 years ago. So calling these hate crimes is appropriate. Why? Because we fear and therefore dislike or hate or have an aversion to that which is different from us. This is part of, unfortunately, human nature in Kali Yuga, those who are are not so intelligent and can't understand these things well. That someone who looks different or acts different or speaks a different language or has a different religion, we dislike that person for no other reason than that. The Bhagavad Gita 7:27 says, "All living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by the dualities arising from desire and hate." So hatred arises from delusion and bewilderment, according to the Bhagavad Gita. And today we're just seeing very extreme examples of this as Kali Yuga progresses. We see, in other words, the age of Kali is at the age where things become increasingly worse all the time, unless there is the injection of spiritual life brought about by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's appearance 500 years ago. But this delusion continues, and bewilderment of people becomes extreme, and so that we see this mentality more and more today. Now, we contrast this to what we read today in today's verse, the position and consciousness of an advanced devotee of the Lord. I'll read the verse once more. The humble sages, by virtue of true knowledge, sees with equal vision a learned and gentle Brahmin, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater, or outcast. This word, sopaka, literally means dog eater, but we don't see so many dog eaters these days. But Prabhupada calls it outcast. And actually, Jiva Goswami explains that this word literally means dog eater, but really means anyone who's a lower class person, who's an outcast or somebody different or, you know, in society not so accepted. But the devotee sees spiritual equality in all living entities. Sees those people that may have bodies that are very different from himself or herself. And that vision even extends to animals and plants. What to speak of human beings? Seeing that the life force, the spiritual essence of every living entity is basically the same. Prabhupada says in his purport that the soul, and in fact the super soul, God himself, is made of Hare Krishna. Is made of these three energies that come from Krishna's sarup, or Krishna's body, Krishna's form. And those are the energies of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So these are the qualities that every living entity essentially has. When you go below all the later layers of the body, not just the gross body, but the subtle body, which is the mind, intelligence, and ego. And you get beyond all of that, and there you have the commonality of the soul, or the Atma, the Jiva. So those who are called Pandita, Pandita means a sage or one who has higher vision, one who is intelligent, who has spiritual knowledge. They see this. They see this equality, and they desire the welfare and the happiness of all living beings. So the spiritual vision, it kind of has two parts or two realizations that are mentioned here. First, that Krishna, God, as the Paramatma or the Super Soul, pervades everything. Krishna is throughout this entire creation. He expands himself everywhere, and specifically as the Antaryami, he expands himself into the heart of every single living entity. That means every human being of every race, of every ethnic identification, religion, or language. It also means into every animal, every plant, into every microbe. Wherever we see life, where we see symptoms of life, there is consciousness. And where there is consciousness, that means it is that there is the presence of the soul. But the presence of the soul also indicates the presence of the super soul. We don't see the soul without the super soul. In the Paramatma Sandarbha, very, very nice book by Jiva Goswami, explains this. And before he talks about the Paramatma, he talks about the soul. First the Atma, then the Paramatma, and the relationship between them. So the Atma has so many wonderful qualities. Every single one of us, even a person we really dislike or a person we think has no good qualities, that's the external body, that's the covering, or it's the mind, the intelligence, the emotions that we're seeing. Because behind that, everyone has this commonality, right? Everybody is eternal. Everybody has full knowledge. Inherently, we all have all knowledge within us, the soul. And we are blissful, Ananda. We have this quality of the Hladini Shakti coming from Krishna directly. Because Krishna has that. Krishna has all these qualities in full, and that's what Prabhupada is saying in his purport. This is the difference. God, the Paramatma, has them in full. Krishna knows, is in the heart of every living entity, so knows everyone. He knows what I'm thinking, knows what you're thinking, he knows everyone, someone on the other side of the world is thinking. I barely know what I'm thinking. In other words, our consciousness is limited really to this body that the soul is incorporating. I mean, sometimes people's consciousness can extend a little bit, there's certain psychic phenomena or whatever, but basically speaking, we really don't see much beyond ourselves or really understand that. We may have understanding of other people, but we don't directly feel it and sense what another person feels and senses or thinks. So there is that difference, But it's important that we understand that that same spirit soul, that same life force that is within my body is within every other body. And that Krishna accompanies through every birth and every life form, whether it's the dog, the elephant, the Brahmin, the outcast, that he goes with them and travels with them and is within every single person. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Anchalila 20:25, the verse says, although a Vaishnav, that's a devotee of Vishnu or Krishna, is the most exalted person, he is prideless and gives all respect to everyone, knowing everyone to be the resting place of Krishna. So if each person, every living entity is a soul and a super soul, then how can we want to harm anyone? Or how can we feel hatred towards anyone? We may not like the behaviors or the activities of someone, but we need to distinguish those within our own consciousness. Those behaviors, that activity that's based upon that person's bodily conception of life, that they are acting on how they are perceiving themselves as their body, we don't want to make the same mistake and see them only as that body. So we need to see both. We need to see the presence of the soul, the super soul, and also see that there are differences. Prabhupada says in his purport, the Brahmin, the outcast, may be different from the social point of view, or a dog, a cow, or an elephant may be different from the point of view of species, but these differences of body are meaningless from the viewpoint of a learned transcendentalist. So that commonality, as we were saying, is there within every soul. And in the 11th canto, chapter 19, Krishna describes the qualities to advance in human life. And one of these is satyam cha samadarshana. Truth is seeing all beings as oneself in happiness and distress. And similarly, verse 632 in the Bhagavad Gita says, the yogi sees the happiness and distress of others. He says, he is a perfect yogi who by comparison to his own self sees the true equality of all beings in both their happiness and distress, or Arjuna. In other words, one is seeing the happiness and distress of another person, one can relate to that. One can see, I experience happiness, I experience distress, this person does also. It may not be exactly the same, but I can have some understanding or some idea, some ability to empathize with another person. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says in his purports on this verse, that truth means seeing equally everywhere. One should see others suffering as one's own, giving up harsh qualities like envy and hatred. So an important aspect of this equal vision is seeing the commonality of experience. So we can understand another person's suffering by feeling some empathy or compassion for them. Now, in this process of empathy, which we think is sort of a modern psychological phenomena, well, it's not. Of course, everything is in the Vedas, everything is in our scriptures. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 10th chapter, 14th verse, there's an interesting explanation of this phenomena. The verse says, by seeing their faces, one whose body has been pricked by pins can understand the pain of others who are pinpricked. Realizing the pain is the same for everyone, he does not want others to suffer in this way. But one who has never been pricked by pins cannot understand this pain. So in the purport to the Prabhupada says, there is a saying, the happiness of wealth is enjoyable by a person who has tasted the distress of poverty. And there's also another common saying the Prabhupada is quoting, Vajya ki bhutave prasava vedana. A woman who has not given birth to a child cannot understand the pain of childbirth. And all of us men whose wives have had children, we've heard this, haven't we? That we can't understand because we had something we haven't experienced. So three examples are given here. One who is pricked by a pin can understand how another person is experiencing that pain. That one who has experienced poverty and is now wealthy can experience those and have empathy for those who have poverty. And then the example of childbirth. And every mother, will, of course, will tell you that that's true. And we can see this sometimes. There was a great industrialist around the end of the 19th century, Andrew Carnegie. I think he started U.S. Steel, very, very wealthy. Is that right? Anybody remember? I think it was U.S. Steel. Anyway, but he started out very poorly. He grew up on a poor farm in Scotland, and his family immigrated to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and one thing led to another, and he became one of the wealthiest people in the world. And so what he proceeded to do, because he understood this, he understood how his own poor beginnings were, somewhat of a handicap, and how he had, by through education and other ways, had been helped. He gave away 90% of his wealth by the time he died. He gave away hundreds and hundreds of millions. He started libraries all throughout the United States. He built libraries and many things like that. So that's an example that's being described here. There's someone coming from poverty who has money can understand the plight of those who are still poor. So we talk about this empathy. Empathy means the identification or vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, or attitudes of another. So you may understand another's pain by witnessing another's pain. You don't necessarily have to experience everything personally. In fact, remember in Prabhupada, he talked about the three classes of intelligence, right? First class intelligence is you just hear and you understand. Second class intelligence, you see happen to somebody. You do it. In other words, so you learn from seeing that experience. And a third class person has to do it themselves and experience the reaction. So this vicarious identification is actually a psychological educational term that's used by vicarious learning, which means that you can learn by seeing another person. For instance, there are two children in the classroom, and the one kid goofs around, gets in trouble from the teacher. Second child, he could do the same thing, but no, he's a little more intelligent. He says, oh, I see what happened to him. Didn't turn out too well, so I'm not going to do that. So he learns vicariously from seeing the experience of others. So in the same way, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is saying that we experience the pain and the suffering is there by the people in this material world. And we understand that, and not necessarily we experience it all personally. And he says, by seeing their faces in this verse implies understanding the commonality of experience. And the word lingayar implies seeing the symptoms in other bodies. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, by seeing the symptoms of one in pain, such as the withering of the face or having experienced oneself, one understands the nature of pain and thereby sympathizes with anyone experiencing pain. Now, who in this material world experiences pain? Everyone, right? That was the right answer. Everyone, we all do. Everyone experiences pain. So that means we have sympathy or empathy for everyone in this material world. And this is the vision of a great devotee of the Lord. This is the vision of a great sage, that he sees that humanity is suffering. Even people who seem to be wealthy and have so much, they're suffering. Everyone is suffering. So by seeing and having sympathy for that, one has compassion. And that's really the understanding is the basis of what we call Vaishnava compassion. Compassion is actually a deeper concept than empathy. It means not just that I understand that others are suffering, but I have the desire to alleviate that suffering. How can I help that person who is suffering? Right? So this is quite, you know, obviously the opposite of somebody who fears somebody who is different and wants to cause harm to them. The devotee of the Lord is out. The devotee of the Lord wants to give all help, all blessings, all mercy to every living entity, no matter who they are, or what they have done. Wants them to advance spiritually and not suffer in this material world. A Vaishnava, or a devotee of Krishna, is described as paradukha dukhi. And what that really means is that one who is never distressed in any condition of life, but he is distressed to see others in a distressed condition. It's paradukha dukhi. This is quoted very often. And Prabhupada says in a purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 4.6.47, a Vaishnava is described as paradukha dukhi because although he is never distressed in any condition of life, he is distressed to see others in a distressed condition. Vaishnavas, therefore, should not try to kill by any action of the body or mind, but should try to revive the Krishna consciousness of others out of compassion for them. The Krishna conscious movement has been started to deliver the envious persons of the world from the clutches of Maya. And even though the devotees are sometimes put into trouble, they push on the Krishna conscious movement with all tolerance. Okay. So these are important concepts, and we see this many places. Jiva Goswami in Bhaktisandarbha discusses the importance of equal vision, starting with verse 106 of Bhaktisandarbha. And he quotes, he talks about equal vision, saying that some distinctions may be made. And Srimad Bhagavatam 329 says, gradations of living entities based on development of senses and consciousness are there amongst different living entities, between trees, animals, and like that. And humans are unique, that they have a higher consciousness to understand spiritual knowledge. So we see both. We see the same soul, that same spark or atma of life that's within every living entity is equal, but at the same time, depending on the particular body the soul is inhabiting, there are some differences. And Srila Prabhupada gives the example in the purport that the tiger is a pure soul and has super soul in his heart, but you may not want to make friendship with the tiger. Might not be a good idea. But you can give the tiger prasadam or have him hear the holy name or try to help that tiger however you can, but he may not be your best friend. Okay. So at the end of this section, Jiva Goswami concludes that respect should certainly be given to those who are serving the Lord, those who are devotees, but respect should be given to everyone, to all living entities, because everyone's body is a temple of God, and that the pure spirit soul is within that body, and also Krishna is the super souls in that body. So he concludes with another Srimad Bhagavatam verse from Canto 3, Chapter 29, 34. Such a perfect devotee offers respect to every living entity because he's under the firm conviction that the Supreme Personality of Godhead has entered the body of every living entity as a super soul or controller. So if somehow or another we could develop this vision of samadarshana, of equal vision, I've seen everyone as being that same pure soul, same part and parcel, a devotee of Krishna, kind of connected with Krishna, part of God, then Krishna's bhakti, that love and devotion, enters the devotee's heart, and it softens the heart and brings about humility. And that humility leads one to want to give God's mercy, Krishna's mercy, to others. And that is the truest and highest compassion. And if somehow or another more people can develop that, not only would our world be a much happier place, we would have a lot less, fewer hate crimes and not have this horrible mentality of one group being against another and constant, you know, hatred, friction, whatever, even if it doesn't, even if it isn't like violence or shooting, I mean, even just the fact of these violent and negative, you know, emotions going out into the vibrational world, into the airways. It's just very, very obnoxious. So the devotee tries his best to respect all living entities, to try to see that spiritual nature and fan that spiritual spark to help that spiritual being blossom, to come out of the coverings of the material body and understand our real relationship with God. Okay, I'll finish that point. Are there other thoughts, questions, comments? Well, we won't be able to hear without this.
Yeah. Okay, so, and she wants to be a OBGYN, right?
Okay.
And it's a lot of, difference right now of pro-choice. And so she asked me what Bhakti Yoga or what Krishna consciousness think about this. I read and I didn't find an answer for her because I know what other religions have or beliefs or have the point of view of this, but I don't know what is the point of view of the Bhakti Yoga. And I don't know if you can give me like a maybe closer answer to this so I can give it to her. But she think like all this suffering, also with the woman, they're trying to make her decision with the body. She wants to see what is the point of view so she doesn't want to feel guilty because she think abortion will be part of her, you know, job if she graduates as an OBGYN. And she say, Mom, I just don't want to disappoint you if I get to the point. That's not the point. The point is I want to ask you what is Bhakti Yoga think about abortion and people and women do taking, you know, that choice. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I can't think of specific verses against it, but Srila Prabhupada spoke many, many places you can look up in that. We certainly do not believe in abortion. We don't agree. And it's good. The spirit soul has entered into that body, entered into the womb, and to disrupt that process, the natural process there, is not right. It's because a lot of this has to do with one's belief or understanding of what constitutes life. So it becomes a kind of a complex question. And our understanding is that when the sperm enters the womb and the egg combine together at that point, I guess you say, what do you call it, the point of conception? That's the beginning of life, okay? So not when the baby's born, because obviously there's life there in the womb. So since there's life there, then to kill that life form would not be right. It would be killing. I suppose there are subtleties about this. You could say, well, what if this situation or that situation? But that's not usually the case. It's usually a matter of convenience, to be honest. People feel their lives are disrupted or they don't have the money or, you know, so many things. And I guess from the most religious perspective, what we should be trying to do is helping those mothers or helping people to be able to have what they need to raise those children nicely, and obviously encouraging that people have children when they have the capacity and when they have the ability and, you know, resources. I mean, of course, these are ideals, I understand. But that's what we should be working for, not how we can just kill more children in the womb. that's not our philosophy. I hope that doesn't disappoint her, but she'll take that on board, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yes, Bruce.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji.
Yes.
Thank you for the wonderful class. Like 5 months ago at FSU, where I'm right now studying, there was this shooting that happened and I was there. So like this guy got arrested and he was a student.
Where was this?
FSU, Tallahassee.
FSU, oh yeah. Yeah.
So like I was there and like I heard the gunshots and stuff, people running around. Well, yeah, the shooter was condemned, like he was caught and like he's widely criticized for this and like, yes, he's now going to get a death punishment or something. But like, I mean, it's understandable that what he did was absolutely wrong because he killed people for no reason. But sometimes like I have this feeling of empathy for that person because when I heard his story, that how his childhood had been really traumatizing for him, how his parents used to fight and like to not just regular arguments and conflicts, but like violence and all, like how his mother kidnapped him like for some custody battle or something. And like how he was really traumatized. He had a really traumatizing childhood. Mm. And sometimes situations make a person, there's this saying that hate the sin, but not the sinner.
Mm-hmm.
So like, sometimes I just worry that like people around us, like they condemn that person, like, oh, he's useless or this person's really bad. But sometimes I feel like to assert this point also that it should be known that his background and circumstances must also be taken into consideration. But should that empathy be expressed in public?
That's a difficult question because you got there's a number of things, but you have the principle of compassion. So we have compassion, obviously, for any victims of anyone you hurt, but then you say shouldn't there also be compassion for that person and everything they went through. And they probably, I can't imagine that too many of these shooters had really good lives, can you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it takes a lot of, you know, psychological destructive things going on in one's life, in most cases, unless you just Ron Yukasipu or something, you know, to come to this position. So we can understand that. We can have, you know, perhaps some compassion for that. But obviously there's also the system, you know, there's also the question of justice, question of, you know, society has to be run. People have to feel safe in a society, you know. So that's there too. And that's also part of our compassion. Our compassion is so that people feel safe. You know, which students shouldn't have to feel like, you know, someone's going to come in and start shooting at them and like that. What you're alluding to is a sort of cycle of violence. And it often happens. I'm a psychologist, and you often see this. You see it in child abuse. You see it in many different areas where someone who has been treated very badly, sometimes often, you know, hurt psychologically, physically, or whatever, as a child, will sometimes, if they don't, you know, if they don't really get help with that, and then they may perpetuate that, you know, and they act out that same thing that they experienced on others, just out of that frustration, you know, and everything, and that's the bewilderment illusion that Bhagavad Gita was talking about, that one falls under. I guess what I'm saying is, technically you are correct. If we are going to have compassion for all living entities, we also have a compassion, I guess, for the killer. But I hate to take that too far, you know what I mean? I mean, let's make sure we have a compassion for the victims first, you know, and then, and anybody can change too. We've seen people, or some people who've worked with our prison ministries. We found people who have been in prisons for very bad, violent crimes have become devotees, you know, taken our books, started chanting, completely changed their lives. So that's possible. And, well, we see so many examples. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave the examples. Jagai and Mate were the worst of sinners, right? Terrible dacoits. They did every possible crime that you could think of. Of course, this was all pastime, but they became saved by Lord Nityananda and Lord Chaitanya, and they became great devotees. So that's the other thing. Change is possible as well. Okay, Richard?
I'm just going to say that.
You know,
I was just going to say that also in Scripture it says that for one who kills, death is actually being merciful to that person, because then they don't have to carry on their next life to be killed.
Yeah. No, that's a real good point. In other words, that's one of our arguments for capital punishment, that the person will actually have to suffer much more over many lifetimes if they aren't punished, you know, for that particular action at that time. So, yeah, that's a good point, too. Anything else?
But if the world becomes Krishna conscious, or like governments become like Krishna conscious,
mm-hmm.
So like in our Vedic system, yes, like we have death penalties for killers and all, because that's being merciful for the next lifetime. But if we educate that killer, or like some criminal, and he actually ends up surrendering to Krishna, so anyways he's gonna get forgiven for that.
Oh, they may be forgiven, but they still may have to go to prison for life or whatever. No, I mean, it's a fact. One can become very Krishna conscious in any situation of life, but that doesn't mean that one does not get the consequences of one's actions. Right? That's going to be there too. And if those consequences lead them to change their life, then so much for the better, to become more spiritual and conscious. Okay, let's take another question over here.
And the violent crimes are done mainly by the crazy people. Crazy people. Violent crimes are done by mainly by the crazy people. Crazy people.
Crazy people,
right? So Prabhupada gives the Prabhupada has a purport here on from Chaitanya Charitamrita, 7th chapter, Adi Lila, 7th chapter. 17 verse. According to Ayurvedic treatment, the entire psychological system is conducted by three elements, namely Vayu, Pitta, and Kapha, air, bile, and mucus. Secretion within the body transforms into other secretion like blood, urine, and stool. But if there are disturbances in the metabolism, the secretion turned into kapha, mucus, by the influence of the air within the body. According to Ayurvedic system, when the secretion of the bile and the formation of mucus disturb the air circulating within the body, 59 varieties of diseases may occur. And one of them is craziness.
Yes, mental illness is certainly a factor here. Good, Jeteri.
I heard something really interesting that there was some violence, a shooting at a school, and several children were killed, the mother or the parents of the person who did this, that people found out about it. I think it was in an Amish community someplace. I don't know. And what the people in the community were going to this family's home, and the people in the house were thinking, oh no, they're coming to attack us. But actually, they came there as a, you know, saying, well, we lost our children and you've lost yours too. So they came to actually show like love and compassion for that. So I was thinking, wow, that's a real example, I think, of compassion
Certainly. Just something I heard. Right. Anything else?
I didn't want to extend it, but just real quick on this young man's question. So shortly after moving here to Gainesville, I was called for jury duty. And I just started a new job. My boss is trying to get out of blah, blah, blah. But I got called and I couldn't get out. And it was a murder trial. And it was a young man who had committed an act of basically unintended violence that resulted in the death of somebody. And so we were tasked with not only weighing evidence, but then also administering, so to speak, the justice as the jury. And so because of the nature of the crime, it was a capital crime. In Florida, by state law, is punishable by death or life in prison with no chance for parole. Those were this young man's two options. It was clearly evident he had done this, but it was also clearly evident he had a very messed up life growing up as a young man, without going into detail. And so there were many people that were in favor of, you know, he should be killed, but the consensus was no. And it was partially due, in law, there's something known as aggravating and mitigating circumstances that are weighed when you administer the amount of the punishment, right? So aggravating or mitigating circumstances. So based on certain aggravating circumstances, we understood, and the defense did a good job saying, this young man didn't intend to do this. He actually, and they gave evidence of his compassion that he showed throughout his life under these very difficult circumstances. My own personal feeling was, he has to pay for the price of the crime. There is no walking away. You touch the stove, even though you don't know it's hot as a child, you're going to get burned. There is no way out of it. You can't say, well, I didn't know it was hot, so why did I get burned? Ignorance is no excuse for punishment, right? As human beings, we're, so that's a requirement. But the idea was that this young man, maybe he could help others to become turned around in his life, in their lives. And oftentimes people who are, and I've worked a lot with prison programs, people often who are in prison who really want to hold accountable, they never have an excuse for why they did what they did. They never say, but you don't know, I grew up in this family, that family. People who really become clear in their vision, I'm accountable, I did do this wrong. And it was totally on me. I made these choices, though they were bad, they were influenced by bad circumstances, family life, etc. Those who really are successful tend to own the responsibility for what they've done. You've killed somebody, their grandfather, their child, whatever. That's also a crime. There's also both sides. Devotees are naturally compassionate, much to like the Amish incident that you referred to. And I remember that in Lancaster. But anyways, it's a similar thing. So it's not just a, you can't just only have the compassion for the wrongdoer. They also did do something. It's very complex. Karma is extremely complex. Krishna says it's very difficult to understand how these things work. It's a bowl of spaghetti, if that makes sense. But anyways, I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. That was very good. Interesting points there on that. And that case was a good illustration. Thank you. Yeah. Maybe one.
Okay. Hare Krishna, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
I'd like to say first, thank you for mentioning Sri Jiva Goswami Pad's Sri Paramatma Sandarbha. In 1.12, he quotes 13.3 Bhagavad Gita, Ketra Gyanam Chapimam Vidhi, that yes, Lord Krishna says, I am the knower in all bodies. The differentiation between the Mayavad and the personalist is that the Mayavad believes the individual soul can also be the knower in all individual bodies. Thank you. My real question is in Bhagavad Gita 2.11, he says, Lord Krishna says, Asochyam anvasochyastvam pragnavaramstra bhasase gachashuna gachasumstha nanu shochanti panditaha, meaning, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. A wise man laments neither for the living nor for the dead. So how can I understand this verse in correlation to the verse of the Anchalila Chaitanya Charitamrita you are saying, that you should feel this sort of empathy, compassion? You don't want to see others in pain, you know?
That's an interesting... it's an interesting sort of spiritual, not a dilemma exactly, but there's two different principles that we have to sort of put together, or that we have to try to reconcile. And the one is do not lament for the living nor the dead, means basically not to see on the material concept of life, right? Not to see on the bodily concept, because if that's all you do, you know, in other words, if your compassion only extends to the person's body, you're only going to help them a marginally, you know, amount in this life, you know. But the true compassion is compassion for the soul, understanding their suffering, and then to try to get them out of their suffering through the actual process of Krishna consciousness, of, you know, hearing, chanting, having them, you know. So, yeah, you know, there's, And this is sometimes the problem is that we have to see both sameness and difference. And sometimes, like I remember when, like I've taken like multicultural classes and, you know, communication, things like that, there's like emphasis on, you know, seeing the differences in others, et cetera. Yeah, but there's also, but we also have to see the sameness in others. So, you know, the differences are there, but we don't so much emphasize those things which are different based upon the body, the grossest little body, and that's what that verse refers to. In other words, if I put all my energy into saying people are suffering, this person's sick and that, and I put all my energy and work in it, that's good. I mean, it's mode of goodness type of activity. But true transcendental activity and true transcendental compassion goes to the next step, to the spirit soul, to try to how to actually help the soul who's engaged in that body and that suffering, right? It's kind of like the idea of, I hate to use the example, but it's a Christian example. What they say about, no, I don't want to use it. There's something about fish. You know, like, better than giving someone fish is to teach the person how to fish. I mean, it was a Christian thing in the, I think, Jesus or something. But anyway, not a good example. Okay. Okay, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you.